Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We know the energy picture is going to change, but we don't know yet how that will happen and what we'll be left with to power our world in the future. There are plenty of options, but each comes with benefits and hurdles. The Switch Energy Project has produced a documentary film on the topic, aptly entitled Switch, Discover the Future of Energy, which will be showing at COSAI. For more information about that and a Q&A with the producer, you can go to the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now by phone from Texas is the producer of the film, Scott Tinker. He is a geologist, the director of the Bureau of Economic Geology. And before the Bureau, he was a research geologist for Marathon Oil. He received his PhD from the University of Colorado, and he teaches as well and lectures around the world. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
I wanted to start today by getting a clear picture of the energy demand, not only here in the U.S., but across the world. And so let's listen to a clip from the film. This is Ambassador Richard Jones. He's Deputy Director of the International Energy Agency, talking about India.
One of the scariest statistics I've heard in the time I've been in this job was told to me by an Indian energy official. He said, you know, we have 600 million people in this country without access to electricity today. Can you imagine providing what the challenge is? That's two United States. Can you imagine providing electricity for two United States? And they want to do it in the next, 20 to 30 years.
They'll be
adding population at the same time. Right. So, and that's going to be coal.
And that's going to be coal. We'll get to coal, but how do you measure demand for energy and energy consumption for the purposes of your film?
Well, it was a fun discussion that Harry Lynch, the director, and I had for a long time. And at the end of the day, we concluded energy is just about people, energy consumption. We are the consumers. So we ended up with a human unit. We looked at how much energy a person in the world consumes in a year. And we normalized all energy units, and they can be crazy from, barrels of oil to kilowatt hours and things that nobody really understands. So we put it all in human terms. How much energy does one person consume? And we put all of our various facilities and discussions in the human year.
Right. That with each facility that you visited in the film, you would say, and put it up there on the screen, how many people this would supply power to for a year.
Yes.
And it was really interesting to see the contrasts. The economy is the underpinning for any conversation about energy supply and demand. You visited the New York Mercantile Exchange. They told you that oil has the biggest impact of any commodity on the economy, and it affects everything.
Yes, it does. It's as a sort of representative of all energy, oil is so important. And the reason that it's true is because oil is really still the dominant transportation fuel. There just aren't many options. A few are coming along and starting to be good supplements, but it really is, transportation is limited to oil and oil products. So it drives so many things in the world, in the economy, and the price. Something people pay attention to. You get to watch it when you fill up your car with gasoline. The pennies click off. So we're very aware of the price of things, and it does underpin so much in the economy. In fact, it's interesting. Six of the last seven global recessions were preceded by a spike in the price of oil, and three of the last four U.S. recessions. So, and I'm not saying correlation is causation. The economy is a lot more complex than that. But energy as an underpinning of the economy, you see a spike in the price of energy, and economic markets react to that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Dr. Scott Tinker, a geologist and producer of a film that will be coming to town. It's called Switch, Discover the Future of Energy. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There was an interesting concept. It's obvious, but it's still interesting, that the higher the price of oil goes, the more oil they'll find, because the longer as time goes on, it's getting harder and harder to find it. It's out there, but it just costs more money to get it.
Yes. Yeah, that's a concept that I think is reasonably straightforward to understand once you think about it. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of oil molecules in the world, and they're trapped in various configurations. If you have more money, you can afford to go after the molecules that are more expensive. So the thought about oil peaking is really a certain type of accessible oil, what we call conventional oil. And that's the oil that flows from the rocks easily. But there's oil that's trapped in rocks that's harder to flow, therefore more expensive, but there's still a lot of it. And until there's a good substitute for oil, because it's so dense and so easy to transport and so efficient, then we continue to pay a little bit more, and there's more oil to find. It's in oil sands, it's in shale oil, it's in oil shales, it's in deeper water environments and this kind of thing. So it's a concept that people think of as a, you know, when you think of oil, you might think of a swimming pool, you're draining at a certain rate and then it's gone. It really isn't that way. True, there's only so much oil in the world, but we don't get that much of it with our current technologies. So as technology advances and price changes, there's more oil that can be produced.
Dr. Tinker, I mentioned that before you were director of the Bureau of Economic Geology, you were a research geologist for Marathon Oil. And I was wondering how you approached this topic and managed to retain some balance and not be swayed by your former employer and just your life experiences with the topic.
Absolutely. You know, it's very fair. You know, we all have biases that we bring. Everybody does, from our own experiences and history, mine included. I was in the research arm of the oil and gas industry for 17 years and did a lot of research on oil and gas reservoirs. So I had that experience, which is some expertise useful. But for the last 14, I've really been looking at all energy. So Harry and I agreed to two things when we started, that we would be objective and that we wouldn't try to make anybody look stupid in our film or pit somebody against somebody else. We've been labeled the documentary of the old school for that. And we would be as balanced as we could. And the reader can decide. So we literally went to the best facilities for each form of energy and interviewed the top people in the world. And I knew quite a few of them. And you see folks like Ernie Moniz in our film, who's now the Secretary of Energy in the U.S. And I've known Ernie a long time. And Steve Coonan and other experts from various places that are very broad thinkers. You know, politically, I think they're probably all Democrats, but that didn't matter to me. It really was looking at the fact-based information as objectively as we could, both pros and cons. And the real point here, I think, Anne, is that no form of energy is perfect. They all have challenges and they all have benefits. There are no silver bullets, if you will, to use a trite phrase. And so that portfolio of energy mixes, what the president is starting to understand and talk about a little bit now, is really not only important, it's actually healthy. And so as we looked at each energy type and the best facilities and sites, we got to see where it is today. What's the status and what are some of the challenges?
You got to go around the world.
We went to 11 countries.
Everything you talk about in the film appears big, literally and figuratively. I used it for my kind of the billboard at the top of the hour, big. You visited the largest coal reserve in the world in Wyoming, where they carve from the earth the equivalent of 3 Panama canals a year. And you interviewed Dr. Steve Coonan, Undersecretary for the Department of Energy, and he talked about the vast supply of coal.
Mm-hmm. Coal supplies about half of the electricity generation in the U.S. and globally is also about half, maybe a bit more, of the primary energy. So the world gets a lot of its energy from coal right now.
And there's a lot of coal left.
There is a lot of coal left, hundreds of years.
Yeah.
In fact, nobody really knows because nobody's gone exploring for coal for many decades.
I thought that was interesting. Does that go to the issue of that's because the prices for coal are not high enough to warrant exploration?
It's just not needed yet. So what Steve is talking about there is what drives energy decisions is energy security. And let me be real clear on how I define that. Is it affordable? Is it available? Is it reliable? And is it environmentally sustainable? Those are the four pillars of energy security. No energy satisfies all of them completely, but coal is affordable, available, and reliable. Three of the four. And so it is used. If you take a pin and put it on a global map right in Southeast Asia and draw a circle around it that's not that big, goes partly into China. Inside of that circle, there are more people living on Earth today than outside of that circle on the whole globe. And they consume, half of their energy comes from coal. They consume more coal there than the rest of the world combined. And because it's affordable, available, and reliable, the part that suffers is the environmental sustainability, both atmospheric and other aspects of emissions. So I think one of the great challenges is trying to transition from something that is so beneficial to raising people out of poverty, you know, providing a little bit of electricity, heating and cooling, clothes, shelter, some food. Energy does that. And then trying to transition into other forms of energy that are much better environmentally, but also come with cost. So that's the great challenge in the energy world today. We haven't explored for coal because don't really need to. We know where it is, and it's being mined. Now, we didn't show in the film, but it's on the website, in that giant pit, and it was big.
It was huge.
Where they're mining three Panama canals a year. They're also refilling three Panama canals a year.
They have to, don't they, by law?
They do,
yeah.
And they want to. I mean, it moves across the landscape, so the material you pull out, you put back in. And we actually filmed, I met with the sustainability biologist out there. They recontour, they replant with natives, they put in the native species. And so the land that had been mined actually looked more like it was before we moved west than the land they're mining towards. So that's a piece of the story we didn't really have time to tell in the film. But those giant open holes are actually moving across the landscape. Unlike some other coal mining, where like a mountaintop removal,
right.
You don't put the mountain back on top. So as with everything, some components of it are much better than others, same in the oil sands, et cetera. You know, mining versus drilling in for oil sands, much different environmental impacts. So people get something in their heads, this is all bad, and that really there's some much better parts of all things energy and some that we probably shouldn't do.
I want to get back to the China and India issue when we return after this break. So we'll be right back with Dr. Scott Tinker. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Scott Tinker, geologist and producer of a film. It's called Switch, Discover the Future of Energy. It will be showing at COSAI. If you want more information about that and about the Q&A with Dr. Tinker afterward, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have a link for you there. As far as the China-India impact on world energy, they're not using, and they don't seem to be able to afford yet, the idea of clean coal. They're depending on it, but they're making a mess of it. And I was wondering what you learned about how long is that going to go on, or is that just the way it's going to be?
You know, it's a good question. They are going to continue to use coal. It underpins pretty much a big part of their electricity market. They are growing in some natural gas with LNG imports and some of their own potential production from shale. They are growing in hydro, Three Gorges Dam, and other major projects. They're growing in wind and solar. They just have a tremendous demand when you industrialize 1.4 billion people. And really, in many ways, on a per capita basis, they don't use much energy yet, but it's starting to happen. It takes a tremendous amount of energy. The scale is something that is just hard to fathom. So they're going to continue to use coal. To make coal clean costs more money, pure and simple. You have to add another unit on a coal power plant if it already exists, or you build a different kind of coal power plant, both of which cost more money. They use more energy, and they cost more money. And then you have to do something with the emissions that you capture, which is usually in the thought being to inject them into the earth. And we study that extensively here at my research unit. But it adds money. It adds cost to it quite a bit, actually. So whether or not China and India move down that road of making coal clean, and by that most people mean getting the carbon dioxide out of the emission stream that goes into the global atmosphere, is still to be seen.
You know, you saw the pictures, I'm sure, whether you saw them on the web or in your newspaper, of the smog problem in, I think it was Beijing recently. Mm-hmm. And as they industrialize and as they, raise the waters and raise all boats, aren't people going to start to demand better air there?
I think so. I go to China quite a bit, heading there in a couple of weeks to Shanghai, and there are days when literally it looks like you're in a completely fogged-in day. You're starting to see that, although the government structure and systems are different, so they have more of a control, centralized control, and a little tougher for some of the things we're used to doing here in terms of voter demands. When it becomes a trade-off between human health, which is happening, and affordability of electricity to drive the economic engine. So that's really what the balance is. And how they work through that is yet to be seen. It's a global challenge, though, Ann, because that atmosphere is a global conveyor belt.
Right.
It's not like local mercury or SOx or NOx in your own air, in terms of right around the plant. This is a global challenge. And rightfully so, the U.S. has put out more CO2 emissions than any nation on Earth to date, but we no longer do. China passed us a few years ago in CO2 emissions, and they're going way past us. Ironically, and in fact, I think as a story most people don't know, is this: the U.S. CO2 emissions have fallen steadily the last 5 years. We're down to 1992 levels here, the largest drop of any nation on Earth, and that is because natural gas has replaced coal in our power plants. That's happened because we have cheap natural gas. That's happened because of hydraulic fracturing. And in Europe, where there are moratoria on nuclear now post-Fukushima and moratoria on fracking in Germany and a few other nations, they're actually taking physical delivery of coal from the plant we showed in our film, from the mine. So it goes across our country on a train, across the ocean on a diesel-run barge and on a train, and they're burning it. So CO2 emissions in Europe have gone up the last 4 years in a row. And that's one of the consequences of choices. And I say to audiences, you can't not like everything. If you don't like fracking, that's fine. If you don't like nuclear, that's fine. That means you love coal. And that's exactly what's happening in Europe today, because those are the three forms of baseload power generation. So we have to look pretty carefully at what the real impacts are and the real consequences of each of these things as we go out into a more renewable future.
You did cover the issue of fracking. There is a lot of controversy about that in Ohio, where the business is just getting started after a few years. You talk to people in Texas. Obviously, you're there. You're more familiar, but with the water table issues and so forth. But you noted that for an average site, some 3 million gallons of water is used to dislodge the natural gas from the rock in the fracking process, and that includes some 15,000 gallons of chemicals. And one of the issues that has been surfaced in Ohio is that of disclosure, that because of what they're injecting into the earth, they should have to disclose what it is in the chemicals that they're using to do this. Now, they say there's formulary propriety and that sort of thing. What do you make of that going forward?
Absolutely should have to disclose it. I don't have any qualms about that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's a website called Frack Focus that's sponsored by the IOGCC, and voluntary now is going forward. Texas was the second state, I believe, to make it a law one session ago that there's full disclosure of chemicals in fracking. I mean, this is just transparency that needs to happen. I don't actually think most of the industry now has a problem with that. Sure, they lose a little bit of strategic advantage, but the bigger picture is you should have to disclose it. More importantly, I think the transition away from some of the chemicals that could be harmful if they went into the water table. And I'd like to talk, if you have time, a little bit about actual fracking versus where real risks to the water table happen. They're different. But those chemicals are being reduced. They're looking at other kinds of things. They're looking at reusing the produced water now instead of using fresh water. That's happening in the Marcellus, a complete reuse of all the produced water. It's starting to happen in other shale plays. So there are a lot of things going on now to go toward that fourth pillar of security, environmental sustainability. And I think it's important, again, to ensure that those are going on, and then always compare the benefits of natural gas from fracking against coal and nuclear. And I think that's one of the things that most studies and most news media don't talk about, is if you're not going to use natural gas from fracking, we are using nuclear and coal. So.
Yeah, you brought up as well, before we move away from fracking, the issue of storage. And Ohio is kind of becoming a dump for fracking waste because of the way our laws are written. And you pointed out in the film that that's really the greater problem going forward that's not getting resolved.
Yeah, so in real simple terms, you inject water at high pressure down deep in the earth and it cracks the rock, and it's intended to do that. There are micro earthquakes that go on by definition. Those cracks do not propagate through thousands of feet of rock to the surface. If it's done real close to the groundwater table, that's dumb. Nobody should permit that, but it needs to be 4,000 or 5,000, 9,000 feet down. When you produce the fluids, they come through the groundwater table through casing and cement, and on occasion that casing job isn't good and it will leak. It's a local problem, but that's not good. That happens with any oil and gas well, forget whether it's fracked or not. So there are ways to ensure good casing. Most of them are very good. Occasionally an operator isn't good. They should be not allowed to operate. I mean, there's just no question here. You get the rogues out of the business, as with any industry. But there's that issue. And then the handling of the fluids at the surface, whether trucks have accidents and leak, the ponds that hold the fluids can breach. These are, again, local things. You know when they're happening, you can fix them and stop them, but they have a local damage to them. And then the big one is taking the produced fluids and reinjecting it in what's so-called disposal wells. Again, mm-hmm. That's been going on for a very long time in right. the oil and gas business. Those disposal wells need to be done well. They go deep in the earth. They mostly are done well. You know, it's not become an issue of awareness until fracking, but they've been going on a long time. But on occasion, again, those can cross a natural geologic fault, lube it up, if you will, and cause it to shift sooner than it would, and that is an earthquake that you can feel at the surface. Doesn't do damage, but kind of in the 3 to 5 magnitude, which is, you know, like a big truck driving by outside. So these are things that can all be handled better. I think most of the industry does them very well. On occasion, you get folks who don't, but these are the regulatory things that absolutely should be done, and it'll cost a little bit more for the industry to do them, but that's what's needed.
You mentioned, you know, we talked about the amount of water that's needed, and you said that they are developing ways to reuse the water. So, but be that as it may, water going forward is going to be a more and more precious and more expensive resource. Do you see that affecting the cost or the expense of fracking down the road?
It could in places where only fresh water is accessible for the hydraulic fracturing.
Okay.
So there's a trade-off, like in South Texas right now, it's dry country, and they're using 5 to 6 million gallons per well. And so in a local area, that access to fresh water, a real irony goes on down there, and this is Texas, is the ranchers require the operators, for the most part, to use their fresh water because they get paid for it.
There's that big aquifer, right?
Yeah, but think about what I just said.
Yeah.
Right? Many of the operators would like to reuse the salty produced water that
right.
comes from the formation in the earth. It's basically old seawater that was trapped there when the sediments were laid down. They'd rather do that, but the operators won't, the landowners won't let them operate unless they pay them for their fresh water. So these are some things that need to get solved, right? We need to protect the use of our fresh water where we can. And let's put it in context for your listeners. We've done extensive studies in Texas. Hydraulic fracturing is about about 0.5% of the total fresh water used in Texas, 0.5%. Most of it's agriculture, then industrial uses, and then you come on down to the surface quarrying, mining, and oil and gas business. But it's still a lot of water. You know, just a lot of water that gets used in all of our daily lives. And I think that as we think about that, we will definitely find ways to be much more efficient in our use of fresh water. Today, most of us just use it like it's there forever. And it's something we have to begin to think about as a real commodity.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest, Dr. Scott Tinker, geologist and the producer of a documentary film. It's called Switch, Discover the Future of Energy. Ben in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I think there is a form of energy Dr. Tinker hasn't necessarily mentioned that satisfies the test of the four pillars. And that would be energy conservation or conservation and efficiency combined. It probably only applies to the developed world where we use the largest amount of energy and the most energy per capita. But the technologies we develop for conservation and efficiency should and could be demonstrated and sold and given to the developing world to try to avert some of the worst catastrophes that we suffered through in damaging our environment with the fossil fuel boom. I wonder if how the doctor thinks of conservation and efficiency in the lineup of energy going into the future.
Sure. Scott Tinker?
Sure. I don't want to give away the punchline of the film, but I learned, I'm not a filmmaker, I'm a scientist, but Harry Lynch, the director, is a documentary filmmaker. And what I learned is how you end your film is if you want your audience to remember nothing else, that how you end the film is what they walk away with. And I completely agree with you. And when you see the film, you'll see how we end the film. And it's quite a bit of an ending, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So we set up the energy unit as the human unit. We start small in my closet, go large to the world, and we come right back to the individual. And we talk about behavior. And the real switch isn't really the switch in energy to us. It's the switch in how we think about energy. It's the change in the way we use energy. And a big component of that is efficiency, changing the way we use energy. And absolutely, we can do better across the board. And when I give lectures, which I do all the time, in fact, my youngest is a girl. She was asked once what her daddy does, and she said, he talks. So that's I focus a tremendous amount on that. Now, that said, we can't save our way out of an energy crisis, if you will, or, you know, it does take energy to do things. And as developing nations grow, the historical process has been to go like China is with the cheapest forms, which have environmental consequences. We can really work to improve that and make them affordable. So it's a dance that goes on. Energy, the environment, and the economy is this waltz that goes on. And efficiency is the fourth E. So I appreciate your comment. We hadn't talked about it yet. But,
yep. We were going to get to it, but I thought I'd let Ben take the reins on that one.
I'm glad you teed it up and really do agree. And, you know, I'll be candid. I've been in energy my whole life. 6 years ago when we started the project, I didn't know that my individual behavior mattered. I'm one of 7 billion people. You know, does it really matter? And I think today that it does. We completely went through the efficiency things in our own home throughout the process. Individually, I'm a small thing, although a big consumer because I have American stuff. But what it does translate to is the way my kids think and the way I act in our business and in our industrial lives. And so the whole cultural switch. That's what we need to do. You know, how many shows on TV can you watch on cooking, and how many on ice road truckers and noodlers, you know, and whatever else, but how many do you see on energy? And maybe it's just something we want there, we want it cheap, we don't want to think about it, but we need to start to think about it. It's time.
Thank you, Ben, for that call. A point was made in the film that as countries industrialize and modernize and so forth, everybody wants a car. And when you look at a place like India or China, it it becomes worrisome because I think, well, they can't all have cars. They're already killing each other every other day. I mean, mass transit is absolutely the way they have to go. What do you have any sense about how those countries are working on that?
Well, I'll share the data initially, then we can talk about. In 2004, China sold 5 million cars. We sell about 15 to 20 million a year here in the U.S., 2004. Last year, China sold 22 or 23 million cars. So they went from a third of the U.S. to one and a half the U.S. in less than a decade. Now, they're not giant trucks like we drive in Texas. They're smaller, more efficient, and they don't drive them as far yet. But they are going down the automobile road, and they run on gasoline and diesel. You know, there's a few hybrids, but not many. India has Tata, which is starting to go down that road as well. So the data are that people want cars still, and they're going that road. Down that road, how do we transition from that line? It's tough. Now, there are some really neat things I've seen throughout my career on ways to manage that system better. Little individual pods that can hook up into, you know, transit systems that are a lot more efficient and move you more efficiently down roads. So you kind of hook on and hook off with your own little pod. Sharing of cars. Getting vehicles that run on different fuels, so natural gas being half the emissions at least, but still emissions. Plug-in hybrids, so you're putting some from the grid and some from the engine. Don't forget the grid is powered by coal, natural gas, and nuclear mostly, and some renewables. Fully electric, again, some of the challenges there. Biofuels. Biofuels are a good liquid supplement. They have challenges, though, you know, scale. And there's energy used throughout. So hydrogen, the fuel cells, these are the options. They're not really huge yet. They only support a small component. So unfortunately, in the near future, it looks like it's the vehicle route. Sir, there are buses. There are some mass transit systems being put in place in the major cities. But there's a tremendous amount of driving that's starting to happen and continuing to happen. You know, I hate being this voice. It's the one where your listeners call in and say, "Ah, this guy's a downer." You know, I'd rather be the guy saying how great it could be if we just had political will.
I want my jetpack.
Yeah, so. Well, you know, absolutely, and what powers that? But I guess what we committed to do was describe the world that is in real terms and how we transition to that new, different world in terms that are. Hopefully achievable by getting out of our corners and having these hard conversations, all of us in the conversations, rather than what we wish could be if the world didn't exist in the way it is today.
My guest is Dr. Scott Tinker. He's a geologist and producer of the film Switch, Discover the Future of Energy. It will be in town soon. You can check a link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Scott Tinker. He's a geologist and producer of a film. It's called Switch, Discover the Future of Energy. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Tinker, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also use our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You know, you've mentioned nuclear a couple of times. These days, it includes the images of people evacuating around the Fukushima nuclear power plant after the tsunami a few years ago. Yet, you point out very clearly, France powers 80% with nuclear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things in energy is energy density. And what I mean by that is how much energy do you get from a volume of something? Gasoline is a very dense form of energy. That's why you can drive so far in a tank. A nuclear uranium pellet, which goes into a fuel rod in a nuclear power plant. So think of something maybe half an inch long and a quarter of an inch wide, you know, a little pellet, and they put them in rods. The energy equivalent in that uranium pellet would let you drive from New York City to L.A. and back to Dallas. You can't put that in your car right now, but the energy equivalent. The benefit of nuclear, or its advantage, I should say, is it's just so dense. You get so much energy out of such a small volume of input. The challenge, of course, is you have to cool it. It makes a lot of heat. And all it does is boil water, make steam, and turn a turbine. It's like burning coal, burning natural gas. That's how these things work. They make heat. Boil water, make steam, turn a turbine. So you have to cool the tower, and that's what those big towers are. And then it produces radioactive waste. So, of course, you have to handle that waste, and France recycles and reprocesses theirs, and they take the little bit that's left, and it's about 5%, 4 to 5% fission products, and they vitrify that or put it with silica and put it in containers, and they're actually putting that in a geological repository, or going to. Right now it's stored in thick cement slabs. It's pretty low volume of waste for the amount of energy that's generated. So the advantage of nuclear, extremely efficient, extremely dense, very reliable. They run all the time. Not a lot of waste that way. Handling the waste. And, of course, then the challenge of a risk. So Three Mile Island here in the U.S. didn't happen but could have. Fukushima tidal wave is the big thing there, and they're still dealing with their cooling ponds that are filled with ocean water now. And then, of course, the big disaster in Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. Which was real. But if you look at a kilowatt hour, which is a measure of output from a power plant, the safety record of nuclear is actually better than any other fuel in terms of human deaths or other kinds of measures. Kilowatt hours generated versus people. And again, I have people come at me really hard when I say that. It's data. So our challenge is really to think about that remarkably dense form of energy and how efficient it is and compare it to other options and alternatives of less dense forms of energy. The least dense are the ones that come from the cleanest, the sun. You have to put a lot of wind turbines up and a lot of solar gathering heat or photovoltaic systems. Covers a lot of land, manufacturing and things, but there aren't any emissions, so... You know, huge benefits on the emission side, but use a lot of land and infrastructure. And because they're so low density, they're more expensive. It takes just a lot more infrastructure to gather enough electrons in the way we use them. And I'm not trying to oversimplify, but that kind of captures it.
The challenges and how to keep it safe.
Mm-hmm.
Just like it is with the big deep offshore oil drilling that's going on. That issue came up. Obviously, you visited the deepest offshore oil drilling platform in the world. The manager there said that they learned a thing or two from the Deepwater Horizon BP oil disaster. What did they learn? Do you get a sense that the nuclear power industry is investing as much as, say, what... The manager of that oil drilling platform said they were in safety.
Right. Yeah. Again, anytime there's humans involved, there's always a risk. And I don't want to scare people, but the disasters that happen, and they're pretty rare, like Macondo with BP or Fukushima, quite often have a man-made component to them, a decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
They are few and far between, but when they happen, they're very, very public because, you know, there it is and it's going on. So what you don't see happening is the several 400 reactors in the world, nuclear reactors around the world, generating electricity every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, the nuclear industry is investing in that, the Generation 3 and 4 reactors, and looking at even beyond that. lower reusing and recycling the fuel, so they're consuming the waste themselves, and it gets lower volume and lower heat. So that's neat technology. The U.S. has not built a new reactor in several decades, so we're still using our older ones. Ernie Moniz, again, has permitted 4 new reactors to be built now in the U.S. to see how that technology looks. So absolutely, the industries continue to invest and evolve their own standards. Oil and gas, what he meant by that, Chris Smith meant, was up until that time, the industry thought they had the ultimate solution, which is called the blowout preventer. It's a big set of clamps that go on the top of a wellbore when something is about to overpressurize and just clamp it off. It failed. That hadn't happened. So here we go on the bottom of the ocean in that case, and they had to invent something. A bell system that they put down and literally capped that thing. The industry now has come together and said, all right, if a blowout preventer fails, what's the next thing? And so that next thing is there. But again, Fukushima, go back to nuclear, they didn't really expect a tidal wave of that magnitude from an earthquake ever. So their diesel tanks were above ground, which were the backup generators, and they got wiped out. So this is, you anticipate everything that you can, and then nature says, whoops, you didn't think about this.
Mm-hmm.
And you could think about it, actually, and think about how to address it, but the costs of that become exorbitant, and we can say, well, they should pay for it. But they as we, and again, here's a really popular sentence I'm about to say.
Okay, Mr. Up.
Yeah, Mr. Up, but you know, we all pay for that. It doesn't matter whether you pay for it at the pump, on your kilowatt hour, or whether you get taxed and the government then subsidizes these things. You can say the government should pay for it. The government's us. We pay for it in taxes. We will all pay for these developments. It gets passed through to all of us. And right now, the American public and most of the world wants cheap energy. Listen to us scream when the price of gasoline goes up. Mm-hmm. Oh, the big oil companies, yeah, they make profit. They're not making that much some years. You don't hear about it. For sure, they make a big margin. But the risks and costs are tremendous. The power companies make profit. If we are willing to pay a lot more, some of these things can be put in place. The challenge politicians have is, do you disadvantage the U.S. economy by paying a lot more? And you have global competition for goods and services and products. So really, it comes down to, what are China and the United States of America going to do with some of these things? Because we are the two big global economies. And then in another sense, the European Union as a union. What are we going to do together to move forward? How are we going to come out of our corners and do some global things that make good sense so that nobody is disadvantaged? And I'm passionate about trying to bring governments and industry and academics together to address those big challenges. But it has to be done together.
Let's take a call from Paul on the nuclear power issue. Paul in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air with Scott Tinker. Welcome.
Good morning, Scott. Hey,
good morning.
I wonder if you see any future for the thorium reactors versus uranium reactors. I heard that India is experimenting with them. The three advantages I've read are, one, you can't have a nuclear meltdown, China syndrome. Secondly, they don't produce fissionable materials for making nuclear weapons. And one that's really good is that the radioactive waste is only dangerous for 100 years versus, 100,000 years.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not a nuclear expert, as we used to say in Texas, nuclear, but say it either way now. But I have talked to them, and I think the points you make are real. One that I would mention that's a little different, because I used to think that too, you can actually make, you can get plutonium from thorium reactors as well. It's a different process, but you can actually get weapons-grade things from them, little different set of reactions. But the other points I think are good ones. We went down a different road here in this country and in Russia with uranium, partly because plutonium came from it, and we were in an arms race at the time. So, let's not be unclear about that.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of it. I think that India is looking at thorium. As you say, the the time cycle, if you will, the half-life of the thing, heat is less. I want to be clear again, though. Rich Mueller is on our film, and he's a nuclear physicist, as is Steve Coonan and Ernie Moniz. And they did explain that the heat, even from the radioactive waste from uranium, it's a few hundred-year problem. It has half-lives out to the 20,000-plus, so it is radioactive, but the intense heat goes away after a few hundred years, so you're not really dealing with something that is nearly as long-term in terms of melting as that challenge there. But I think thorium, and another one I really have begun to like, is the distributed reactors. The small modular reactors is what we call them. You know, a smaller scale can be put out in communities where you don't have to transmit the electrons as far over big power lines with line loss and that kind of thing. Again, more modern reactors, smaller volumes of waste that can be recycled and reused. And you say, well, yeah, but isn't that risky and new? And I'd go back and say, well, no. We've been putting small modular reactors on the oceans for many, many decades. You know, they're called nuclear aircraft carriers and submarines. Hmm. So, you know, those are all run on a little nuclear core, and they float. So, again, some of these things are very doable as part of the mix should be done. And when you think of the benefits, the emissions out of them is essentially zero. So they are CO2 zero, as well as other kinds of SOx and NOx and mercury and other kinds of products that come from fossil fuels. So I'm not a nuclear guy, but I am very, in my forecast at the end of the film, you'll see that I see nuclear growing. There are about 29 reactors being built in China today, not on the books, being constructed. Saudi Arabia is constructing some nuclear reactors today. India, of course, as you just mentioned, is heading down that road. They have so many people, and they know they've got to provide electricity.
Paul, thanks for that call. I wanted to get a quick cut in from the film again. Wind is gaining acceptance. You talked a little bit about the renewable and alternative fuels. It's gained acceptance, though, where it must in the United States, which is where it's windiest. And this is Cliff Etheridge of the Roscoe Wind Farm, Texas. He talked about the changing attitude.
It destroys our crops. We have sandstorms. It blows our soil away. And you talk about it, an attitude adjustment. Now we've had it, 180 degree attitude adjustment, yeah, relating to the wind. It's right. Just been phenomenal.
That's another thing about Texas. They've got a lot of wind there. Just generally, we have about 2 minutes left, Scott Tinker, but could you talk about the renewables, the alternatives, and how they fit into the matrix of this?
Sure, and we covered them really extensively in the film.
Yes.
If you notice in the film, he had one arm. He lost it in a combine as a kid, and he said, you might say I did this single-handedly.
I didn't notice that. Okay.
He's a character. Texas has 13 gigawatts of nameplate capacity installed in wind and continues to grow. It's a great resource. It's not cheap. It's about the same on an installed capacity as coal. You get about 20% of it when you throw in all in with wind in global production. About 20% is usable because of, you know, wind coming and going. But it has a lot of benefits of certainly clean. You have to back it up and with something because it comes and goes, and we use electrons in real time. So you have to have something that's able to come on and provide electricity when the wind is not blowing. And that's the challenge. You have to have these partnerships. Natural gas is the best partner to renewables because it can come on quickly. It's cleaner. But mostly it can come on quickly and then be shut off quickly. And so the biggest one with renewables is storage. I'll try to be very brief, but don't store energy well. We've got to store it in large scale, and then the landscape changes. You can use the renewables when they're generated, store the electricity in various forms or as heat, and then use it when you need it. So I say to young people, boy, go out there and study energy storage, and you'll change the world.
Well, Dr. Scott Tinker, I want to thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
Scott Tinker, he's a geologist and producer of the film Switch, Discover the Future of Energy. It will be airing in Columbus at COSI. If you want to get more details about that, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. There'll also be a Q&A with Dr. Scott Tinker at that time. Thanks to the All Sides staff this week, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Julia Hyder, Andrew Zissler, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Aber Karsmitsky. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of Ohio State University.